Welcome back to another episode of Franchise Euphoria. Josh Brown here, and as a franchise lawyer, I get to spend my days helping people with their franchise legal needs. But on this show, I get to talk with people in and around the franchise world and learn from their perspective and their experiences, and also share some of my own. Enjoy! Hi, welcome back to Franchise Euphoria. Thrilled today to have on Alicia Miller. How are you, Alicia?
Good.
Well, I love your background. I mean, you are an entrepreneur yourself. You were a multi-unit franchisee, going back a little bit. You're a longtime contributor and author to Franchise Times, Forbes, Entrepreneur Magazine, I'm sure others. You're now a full-time author, right? You've got a book coming out here, and in the next few days, we'll chat about. And you've also got an advisory type company called Emergent Growth Advisors that you founded and direct, and it's all kind of focused around franchising. And so I love that because you've seen a lot of this from a lot of different angles, and you've experienced yourself. So welcome to Franchise Euphoria. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I mean, we'll spend some time here during this interview talking about your book, and you kind of you address the private equity infiltration into franchising, which is great because I don't know very many other people who are talking about that, but I see it in my practice. And of course, when private equity gets involved, people get interested because there's this whole notion out there that big money coming into franchising and these entrepreneurial founders get all excited and giddy and step all over themselves, you know, trying to get that business grow so that they can attract that money. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But tell me about your experience as a franchisee.
Sure. Well, you know, I came into franchising like many people do. I was sort of a corporate refugee. I worked for over 20 years in high tech. And the last job I had was heavy travel. So I ran global sales operations for a large consumer electronics company. And I was always on airplanes, which was great for a while. But when I had my daughter, I just decided, you know what? I can't leave her and fly to China and be gone for 2 weeks. It's not going to happen. So I decided I wanted to run my own business. It'd been something I'd been thinking about for a long time. And I ended up becoming a multi-unit franchisee in the child services sector, education. And I loved it. I picked up a number of units that were kind of in distress and fixed them up, you know, improved them, and then ended up selling them in about 5 years, which was great experience. But once I came into franchising, I couldn't really see myself doing anything else. So I transitioned at that point to doing franchise development and then more traditional management consulting strategy work. That quickly got me to working with private equity because private equity has sort of taken over franchising in many ways, and in I think positive ways mostly. But through that work, I realized that there's sort of a lot of misconceptions around franchising in general, as we all know, and certainly private equity, and the mashup of the two even more so. So I realized there was a gap, and you know, there had been a little bit of writing about it here and there. But nobody had sort of told the entire story and what it means and, you know, how people should plan their own businesses sort of around this dynamic. So that's now kind of at the center of my consulting practice and certainly the book that is coming out.
I feel like that's a common theme in franchising, right? I mean, it's like, this is only part of the story. I think you could start that off with everything because... Yeah. You know, when franchisees, prospective franchisees are looking at systems and they're trying to figure out and do their own due diligence on, you know, what they should be looking at, they look online and they get fed a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, it's just a business in a box. You turn over your money, you flip on the switch and boom, all this business is going to come. And it's this whole, you know, golden dream. And you know, sometimes that can happen, but my experience in working with folks is that when you're looking at a concept or when you're looking at concepts, right, you kind of have to think, number one, with the end in mind, right? Would you agree? Like, what's your goal, right? I mean, when you got into the daycare franchises, were you just looking for a way to do something different and to kind of use or try to use, you know, your entrepreneurial skills, or did you have a process you went through at that time, or something that just kind of developed after?
Sure. I think I was learning about franchising like everyone else, and it was child education, tutoring, not daycare, but still.
Oh, okay. Tutoring. Yeah.
Yeah. The process I went through, though, was still, I think, a fairly standard process that most people new to franchising go through, where they, you know, they sort of narrow down the sectors that they're interested in. Usually, you know, the hard cut is food or not food, right? And then you start narrowing from there. And, you know, I talked to a number of different concepts. I read the financial disclosures and so on. But my level of sophistication of how I evaluate systems is certainly much better now than it was as I, you know, first came into franchising. And I think one of the takeaways from all of my work with private equity has been, you know, that lens that they use to look at a business is actually a really useful thing to sort of piggyback on as you're thinking about, you know, becoming a franchisee. How would that franchise system look to an outsider like a private equity investor who's not as emotionally attached to this decision as I might be as a franchisee? You know, I think that thought process is very useful. And I wish that I had had that thought process when I was evaluating brands.
Well, you said something in another interview or maybe in one of your articles that I read that I thought was a really salient, great point that I never thought of. And that was, private equity doesn't take crazy risks. They don't really take risks. They bet on what they think is, in their eyes, a sure bet.
They try. Yeah.
They try.
Think about their mandate, right? So a traditional private equity firm, so this is someone who's raising money from pension funds, university endowments, you know, wealthy families, sovereign wealth funds, right? They've got the average hold time within that group is 6 years. The average fund is 10 years. So there's, you know, it's a little bit of a time-bound problem. They can't take on turnarounds. They, you know, in most cases, they can't take on mess because they just don't have the time to clean it up. Their job is to accelerate growth. That's what they're betting on. So that lens already cuts out a lot of potential brands that aren't quite, you know, that solid yet or too small, because PE also can't usually write small checks unless they've got a dedicated fund to microcap sort of investing. So the field of what they're interested in is pretty narrow, but people have this misconception that they're like these swashbuckling risk takers that come in and boldly go where no one else wants to be. That's not a traditional private equity firm. That's not really what they do. It doesn't mean they're not willing to fix some problems, but they've got to be fixable in the short term, right?
Well, in my experiences too, is it all depends on the business too. As an example, I've seen of late, and I don't know if you would agree with this, Alicia, or not, but I've seen of late, like in the tech sector where, you know, obviously one of the prevailing issues of our time is cybersecurity, cyber fraud, technology. And so you have a lot of businesses that are in the franchise sector that focus on technology and security for businesses, more of a B2B kind of play. Mm-hmm. That's one example where I've seen private equity come in, and even where a business may have, you know, 20 locations open, but they've got a whole bunch in the pipeline that aren't open, where maybe there's some, you know, why aren't these open? You know, what's going on here? They're set on that market or that sector being such a viable sector that they're willing to take a little bit more risk on that other end because they want to get into it and they want to get into an operating company. And they know they can fix certain things the other way. The other side, this is a two-parter. The other side of that is, it's interesting because private equity, so often when they come into a traditional business, it's not a franchise, is so used to controlling everything, including if you have a non-producing location. They can just come right in. Hey, we're closing you down. And it's like, a lot of times they're kind of like, wait, we just can't do that in franchising.
Oops. Yeah. Well, that's been some of the, you know, as I looked at the history of PE and people say, well, you know, how successful has PE been in franchising? When there have been mistakes, one of the bigger mistakes really happened much more frequently early on in the history than it does now. They've learned, right? They've learned by example, and they've learned through experience, and they're better at due diligence now than they were before. But I think they've also learned that turnarounds in a franchise system are really hard because you've got all these independent franchisees, right? These are independent business owners that may or may not be on board with your change agenda. And it's going to take time for true, you know, willing adoption to happen. And so you can't just come in and dictate, all right, here's what we're going to do. And I think you see this even in really big publicly traded systems. The RBI recently bought out Carrols, for example, because Carrols was an independent, you know, multi-unit franchisee that had a lot of remodels it needed to do and was going to do it on its own timetable. And RBI finally said, nope, we're going to buy you out because we want to accelerate these remodels, right? So, I think some of the mistakes early on were just a little bit of overconfidence that they could come in and make changes faster than they actually could make them. And the other big mistake, which I sometimes, I mean, we still see now, both in PE-backed brands, but even in publicly traded brands, is this notion that corporate can dictate change without investing itself in the change, right? You can't just say, okay, franchisees, go spend this money on these changes without putting some skin in the game yourself. And we've seen those change agendas, like eventually they figure out, okay, we're going to have to put some real money behind this thing, right? So they launch a big initiative to go and, you know, do rebranding or to do menu refresh or to launch breakfast or whatever it is. That's been a switch in approach. Whereas in the, you know, in the earliest days, they kind of pushed harder on franchisees to shoulder all of that responsibility. And now I think they've come to the realization that it's got to be, you know, both sides have got to invest.
Can you do me a favor? Because we, you know, you and I live in this world, and so the language is, we're used to it. But for anybody who, you know, there's a lot of people who have notions of what private equity is and what that means for your business. Can you break it down in terms of somebody who's listening, who's growing a business, and may think, hey, you know, my goal is to have, you know, private equity come and offer me some crazy deal. And so what does that really mean? You know, when somebody sells a business, if you come and you buy my business, Alicia, we enter into some sort of a purchase agreement for an amount of money and we close the deal. Probably I stay on for a little bit to help make sure everything is smooth going forward. And then I'm out of it. Tell me about when PE comes to the table, when outside capital like that comes to the table.
Sure. So I think it's important to recognize that they're not a homogeneous group. There are as many flavors of private capital as you can think of, right? So there's traditional private equity backed by pension funds. There's family offices. There are wealthy individuals who really skew more toward angel investing than, you know, a true private equity sort of experience. But, you know, they can come in early and provide capital and sometimes entrepreneurial support and assistance. You know, sometimes they're experienced business owners. There's large investors like pension funds in some cases want to invest directly in some of these larger brands. There are hybrid investors. There are, you know, that kind of look a little bit like two different groups. There are strategic platforms that are coming in and making investments. There are independent sponsors who are usually ex-operators or current operators who are then are going to go, they don't have a dedicated fund to invest out of. They have to go raise the money before they can invest. And there's also a lot of pretty creative private debt options too, sometimes funded by private equity or a private equity fund. Sometimes will debt will be part of the equation in addition to an equity investment. So rather than trying to decipher this alphabet soup of all the options available to you, my advice is to really soak on what is it you want to accomplish personally and professionally with this brand. And if you can define that very tightly, then you can get help to find the right partner for you rather than sort of looking across the marketplace and trying to figure out who's a match. You're better off spending the time figuring out what you want. And then that's the best way to find a match ultimately.
Yeah. And there, I mean, there's tons of different options. I think the one thing we could probably say uniformly is that whenever you go out and get outside investment, whether it's through, you know, private equity or otherwise, things change within your system, right? I mean, it is going to change. And so there's this whole notion of, you know, you start a business and you're really starting it to think, okay, I want to grow this thing and sell it, or maybe I want to pass it on to my kids, or, you know, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. But one thing that's for sure that we've all seen is that, to what you just said, Alicia, which is, if you don't have a clear notion of who you want to be in business with or who you're selling out to, there are loads of stories out there where people are very, very unhappy with that transaction. I think it's important to understand that part of the equation. I mean, I think, you know, there's all the good sides, all the upsides, and we hear about all of that and we see all of that. But I know myself, I've talked to a lot of people who, if they had to do it over again, may have done it a little different. And when pressed, they would say, yeah, I really didn't think about the things that ultimately became more important. In other words, what's the legacy? What's my legacy as the founder? If I sell this thing, take a big paycheck, but then it goes in a direction that I never anticipated, or that takes the culture away from the company, or something like that. Talk a little bit about that.
So this is a common thing that's very hard for founders, is when they start thinking about bringing on private capital. It's usually because they have a growth agenda and they want the brand to be bigger, right? Their vision is to grow into hopefully someday a global brand of consequence. And they realize the path to accomplishing that is probably faster and more certain with the right partner. And in the process, they can take some chips off the table. But if you sell a majority of your business, you have sold a majority in your business, right? So now you are no longer in control. Now, most traditional PE firms would not want to buy a business if the management team wasn't strong and backable. So their working assumption is that you are going to stay on for some period of time. Because otherwise there's that risk element again. If they know they're going to have to replace the leader right away, you know, that's not something they would like to have to do, ideally. So if you're looking for a full exit, let's say you really do just want to retire, you need to have a team underneath you that can sort of step into that role and let you step away. But if you're going to stay in it, things change. You know, you've got a board of directors now. You can't just go hire somebody that you want without consulting with the board. You can't, you know, spend money the way you were used to spending money. And everything that sponsor cares about will be tracked and measured. And I've seen sometimes there's frustration because you have gut instincts about the business as an entrepreneur. You've been in the business a long time. It's sort of steeped in your personality and in the culture of your business. And you just sort of know things about the business. And your sponsor wants all those things measured. And everything is precisely knowable in their eyes. And so there's this conflict sometimes where the entrepreneur says, well, you know, this is just the way it is. I know this to be true. And they're like, nope, we're going to go back and measure that. We're going to go back and we're going to look at that decision again that you've already made. And we're going to go validate that decision. And that can feel frustrating for somebody who's used to calling their own shots for so long. So the trade-off to you has to be worth it. Again, go back to your goals. What are you trying to accomplish here? Is it worth giving up that autonomy in order to get the help to get to the next level and to challenge you in some ways that maybe you haven't been challenged before? If the culture matters, you know, this is another thing that's sort of interesting. In that first transaction, the founder obviously is choosing who they're going to be selling equity to, right? So that cultural alignment can be a big part of that first transaction. But in the second transaction, the third transaction, and down the road, by that point, the founders usually left the business, and now it's under the control of a professional management team and another sponsor. The culture can change. Sometimes the culture changes in good ways and sometimes not, but the culture will change. And that can be especially jarring for franchisees who came in under the founder, right? They gelled with the team. They liked the culture. That's part of why they got into the business. And now the culture is going in a different direction and it might not feel as good. So as a franchisee, you know, look, the market's dynamic. Lots of things about the business can change. So you've got to be sort of constantly maintaining the state of sale readiness because, you know, things happen and you may decide this isn't going in a direction I want anymore, or this is no longer a fit for my lifestyle and where I, you know, the season I'm in my life. Got to be ready to make a call and hopefully, you know, get a good exit out of it. Don't keep going along. If it's no longer a fit for you, then sometimes you just need to recognize that and, you know, craft a good exit and move on.
You talk to, and you reference companies that avoided PE, that just haven't done it. They could just continue to grow and grow rather large. What's your sense on why they do that? Because you know that some of these companies, they're constantly bombarded with opportunities and options. Once you hit a certain revenue level, you get those opportunities in a lot of businesses. Not all, but in a lot. What is it that you see for the founders who resist it? I mean, that's a really, you know, there's an honor in that to a certain degree. There's a discipline. Mm-hmm. There's a stick-to-itiveness and sorts of there's also, I think, a recognition by them. And whenever I hear about somebody who does that, I think this is a person or this is a team that really knows what they're all about. Not because PE is bad, but because they have been able to withstand that pressure and push and say, no, that's not what we're going to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it falls into a few camps. First is they don't feel they need them. They're growing just fine. Thank you very much without the help. And they don't feel that now is the right time. At some point they may change their mind, right? Some will say, I'm keeping the business because I plan to pass it on to family. Another great reason not to have a transaction, just hang on to it. And, you know, over time transition to your kids. I just met with a CEO about 2 weeks ago asking the same question. He's got people pounding on him, wanting to, you know, do a transaction with him. And he's like, nope, my three sons and I run this business and we're doing really well. We're expanding internationally and got great cash flow and franchisees are happy. We're just going to keep running with what we've got. We've got a great culture and a great offering and that's fine, right? I think also there's been a history where, you know, a lot of these firms that have reached scale got to scale before PE itself was even an industry, right? So like Subway is a good example. Subway got to scale before PE really even came into franchising. So once you hit a certain point, you really don't need the capital anymore. And then it's a question more of, is the strategic assistance something that makes sense for our business? But yeah, I mean, there's nothing that says you have to sell at any point. It's, again, what are your objectives? What are you trying to do?
Well, I want to talk about your book, Big Money in Franchising, Scaling Your Enterprise in the Era of Private Equity. But I want to talk about one other thing before we jump into that, and that is emerging brands. Because all of this that we're talking about, all these opportunities, all these exits and so forth, are all premised on a brand that had to start from somewhere. Yep. They had to start.
That first brave franchisee.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you have amazing articles on Franchise Times and other places, but the ones I'm thinking of on Franchise Times being about, you know, emerging brand missteps and other things where you consistently talk about and see mistakes that can be avoided, but aren't avoided. Talk about that, because there's people out there listening who are right in this moment, right? They've just launched their brand. They think, okay, let me go grow this thing. What are some things they should be thinking about so they don't make the common missteps?
Sure. I think, look, it's a lot, right? You've started this business, it's successful. And then one day a customer says, hey, is this a franchise? Have you thought about franchising? Right. Or you get a phone call from a consultant who says, you know, have you thought about franchising? All of a sudden you're drinking from the fire hose, trying to learn about this thing called franchising and what makes a good, viable, sustainable franchise business. And then on top of that, you've now got this new dynamic that you might even not be aware of, which is private equity's impact on franchising, which is something to seriously consider. So people will launch their franchise and start selling licenses. And unfortunately, I think that they need more help early to build right in the first place. And if you keep the notion of responsible franchising, you know, high quality franchising always at the front of your radar, everything else will work out. So even if you don't master this whole list of things you need to know, as long as you stick to that, you'll probably be okay. But unfortunately, I think we've got somehow emerging brands have gotten the message that they have to get to 100 units open as fast as humanly possible. And they often will do that through outsourced sales organizations rather than organically building a buzz within their community. And their, you know, they start attracting customers who then become franchisees. And then, you know, the uncle or the brother sees how well that franchisee is doing. And suddenly you get this sort of viral thing happening. Those brands tend to do better in the near term because they've got a following rather than sort of selling their way into somebody's notice.
Pause on that for one thing. That is so important. Sure. I mean, the pattern I see a lot is a company turns into a franchise. They don't have enough capital or they don't have the ability to get enough capital to really grow it the way that they probably want to a little bit. They've spent a lot to get this thing turned into a franchise and they need those sales. They need those sales. Yeah. Yet at the same time, and this is not always the case, but you see this a lot. They don't truly know who's a great franchisee or who's not because number one, they've never done it, right? Number two, and I think this is super important, when you go from being an operator of 2, 3, 5, 7 locations to now being a franchisor, your role drastically changes. You are no longer 100% concerned with these 7 locations. You're now concerned over the growth of an entire system and how you can provide value at the outset for a franchisee, but most importantly, or equally as important, value down the road once the franchisee knows how to run the business. Then they're going to go, hey, what have you done for me lately? And what's the value of this system? But unfortunately, people get into this cycle where, okay, wow, now we need to sell. Now we need to sell. Well, the brokers come knocking on the door and hey, we'll go sell this for you. You don't have to really pay us anything, but other than when we sell it, we're going to take either all or a large percentage of your franchise fee and maybe try to tie into your royalties, you know, for the lifetime. But we've got great brokers, great salespeople, we'll go sell this thing. And that can work really well. It can also create disasters because their incentive is to go and sell as many as possible. And if you're a good steward to the franchise as a franchisor, your incentive should be to grow, but to grow slow and steady with the right franchisees, not just anybody who has a check who can come into your system. And that's where everything kind of butts heads, it seems like.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't, there's plenty of brands that need that outsourced sales help, and it can be critically important to the growth of the brand. And there's, you know, fantastic brokers out there who take very seriously the well-being of the people they're coaching and do a lot of work to vet brands to make sure that it really is a good fit. But, you know, there's a spectrum of behavior and not everyone does the right thing at all times.
Am I just overly negative? Am I just soured on this whole? I mean, I think there's good ones out there too. I just see so much bullshit and like so much negative. It's like, what are these brokers doing now? I have great friends who are brokers, and you're right. People do the right thing. It's always just the bad actors that give everybody the bad name.
But here's the thing, you know, I don't think we can say, oh, it's, you know, outsourced sales fault. Look, it's your business. You're the franchisor. You're responsible for deciding who gets in. Who are you approving? So if you let somebody in the door that's really not a good fit or is undercapitalized or hasn't been properly vetted or comes in with misaligned expectations because you haven't done a good job of understanding what they heard during the sales process, that's on you. And so I reject this notion that you know, we can entirely blame, you know, any contractors.
That's a really good point. That's a fair point. That's a very, very fair point. And actually a very, very good point. At the end of the day, the buck stops with the franchisor, the buck stops with the business owner.
And in theory, you should know, or you should have tried to really understand who's going to be successful in your brand. And this is a common like pain point that franchisors have early. Is they're really good at building up, you know, 5, 10, whatever corporate units or 2, however many they have, but they haven't really defined what it takes for somebody else to go and run that model. That's the hard part, is how do you take what you do naturally and turn it into code that someone can then follow, right? And also, you've got to understand that if your business, if you've been successful because you're a heck of a salesperson and you're really good at converting leads, you can't assume that everyone you recruit is going to be equally as good at that, even if you're screening for that kind of skill up front, right? So you've got to really pound on, how systematized is this thing? How replicable is this model? How much does it really depend on the skills and efforts of the franchisee? That's where the risk really can get baked in.
Don't you think it's impossible? I mean, I don't know how you get the systems truly down and understand, you know, the replication of the model without having, I mean, certainly minimum two locations, but I even think three or more locations open and running for at least a year, so you have some sort of track record. How else do you do it? I don't know any other way.
I don't either. I agree with that. Also, if you think about how competitive things are now for franchisee talent, you can expect that your own ramp up as a franchise is going to be slower than you want it to be. Now, you may get lucky, but you need to be very well capitalized. And one way to do that is to have a few more corporate units, so you've got some cash flow and you can hire help and support. And there, that gives you some breathing room, so that if you do work with outside salespeople who've got commissions you're paying, you're not so dependent on that franchise fee revenue because you've got corporate units. Also gives you bench strength and a place to train people, to try out things before you take them to franchisees. There's a lot of benefits to having at least a handful of corporate units that are well run, you know, before you start to launch your franchise.
I think that's an excellent point. I totally agree with that. When you know, one way to avoid a cash crunch as a new and emerging franchisor is to have enough corporate units open that are running well, that are making money. And not only does that help you to grow, because it takes you out of the cash crunch, which takes away some of these decisions that can be pressure cookers, when it's like, hey, at the end of the day, let's find the right opportunities, but we're making money because these are corporate locations and presumably they're doing well. You know, when you're a franchise system, you know, the money you're making is the franchise fee. And if you've got brokers, you're not making a lot off that because you're paying them a good amount of that, but the ongoing royalty streams and whatnot. That's a very different model from a corporate location where, you know, the more of the money is flowing your way. And so I often recommend to people that, yeah, I mean, you should have several locations open. You can always decide to turn them into franchises, sell them as franchises, but you should keep that revenue going. Not only do you fine tune the model even more, you're in the game, you're getting more cash flow, and it takes away some of these unnecessary pressures that you're seeing on a lot of emerging brands.
Yeah. Also, when you expand into new markets, dropping a corporate unit into a market that you haven't proven your concept works in yet is one strategy that should be considered. Like, let's say you're an emerging food brand and you've got a style, let's say it's a barbecue brand and it's hot in your market. Well, as we know, barbecue is very polarizing, right? Every region's got their special way of doing things. You know, before you assume that what works in Tennessee works in Idaho, it might be good to put something in the mountain states and have a sort of base of operations, which can also be a place where you can bring franchisees and you can prove that the model works in different places. You can always refranchise them later, but it does help if you're going into a new region and there's an element of, well, is this concept going to work in this region? You know, that can be one way to address that without taking that risk on the back of a franchisee who's, you know, signing a personal guarantee and their 401k over to be your test bed in a new region. It might be better to consider, you know, doing that test yourself under a corporate unit. And then, you know, then you can blossom out from there in that region.
Barbecue is a great example. That's one of those where I feel like franchising is hard in that realm because there's this notion, and it's like baked into our culture, that people who want barbecue want to go to that hole in the wall that, you know, barely passed the health inspection you know, whatever, but the food's amazing somehow, right? I mean, it's just like you just see like that's what people want. People they're not looking for sort of this, you know, not always. I mean, you see differences, but barbecue's one of those funny areas in food. Alicia, we could talk about a lot of things because you've got such great experience in franchising. I want to turn to your book though, because I'm really excited for the launch of your book. It's again Big Money in Franchising. I think it officially goes on sale. You can get pre-orders now, but officially what, March 12th?
March 12th. Yep.
Through Amazon, through is it going to be in some bookstores or are bookstores
Yep,
around
bookstores.
anymore?
Well, the few that are around, it'll be in Barnes and Noble, but Amazon is, you know, a good place to start.
Well, so what I like about this is so in this day and age, you know, there's a lot of people who are, you know, self-proclaimed authors and they, you know, they self-publish and launch. There's nothing wrong with that, but I would consider you a serious writer. I would consider you a person who does your homework, who's got a lot of experience. And I know you did a tremendous amount of research for this book. Talk us through that a little bit. What all went into this book? Because you're diving into a subject of private equity that, you know, began, you know, not that long ago in franchising. I think it began probably with what, Bain Capital and maybe Roark, maybe some of those players early on. But that wasn't that long ago. So I'm curious what your process was for researching this and how you kind of put it together.
Yeah, it took about a year, rough and tough, but, you know, during weekends and evenings and so on. But it was one of those efforts where I was trying to take all these complex threads and turn it into a narrative, right? So how, let's break this down. So, but every thread I pulled on seemed like there were more threads behind it, and that's what took so much time. So, you know, it starts off talking about the history and sort of who are all these different players and how do they invest and why do they invest and what are they looking for and what's their shopping list of what sorts of things they want to see and what turns them off, right? So you can sort of get grounded in that. And then I re revert back and talk about some of the history because, you know, franchising has been around for more than a century and got to be very globally successful without PE being anywhere involved. And PE only really came in the 90s. So talking about sort of what happened to make them suddenly come in and then their first learnings and missteps and, you know, how they went on from there. And then talk about how people make money, you know, riding this wave. And, you know, there's ways to do it in terms of organic growth in the business and investing in growth. And then there's also opportunities to make money through arbitrage, right? So especially through tuck-in acquisitions. So we go through a lot of that math. And then talk about sort of the pros and cons, what PE's done well, what they've learned through various mistakes. There's a ton of case studies in the book.
What
And
did
then
you learn? I mean, what surprised you? I mean, you obviously went in with an idea.
yeah.
What kind of surprised you as you kind of put this together?
I think what surprised me is how fast they came in, first of all, and took everybody sort of off guard. I mean, it wasn't a coordinated attack. It was a group of investors with money to spend looking for great ideas. And one day they woke up and went, aha, franchising. What a great business model. I love this business, right? And all of a sudden they just swept in. And the industry was kind of like, oh, wow, it got kind of warm in here. Where'd all these PE guys come from? And it sort of just increased from there. And I think there's still a lot of people who show up to these to like the IFA conference, for example. There were a lot of private equity people at that conference. And they look around like, wow, there's a lot of private equity guys here. You know, I'm kind of surprised how many are here. Well, they shouldn't be surprised, right? Because they're always looking for great ideas and markets to invest in. I think the other surprise that I had was the mistakes. You know, I feel I know a lot of private equity investors. They're great at what they do. And but going back through the history of what didn't work out was educational for me as thinking about how to do better going forward and how to select an investment, how to, you know, think about a franchise business and when those mistakes were made. Gosh, if somebody who's does nothing but due diligence as their career, when they don't do good due diligence, you know, that's like, wow, okay, I need to learn from that. What, how did they miss that?
Now,
So
do you think
that's
ultimately
really.
you have a very positive outlook on all of it, which is fantastic, right? Because I think the easy thing is to look at, you know, some of the negative stuff as I highlighted earlier, you know, but I think that, you know, would you say that you know, do you feel over the next couple years as PE kind of infiltrates even more, into this space, it's going to make franchising even stronger, right? Because it's going to up the game.
I think it ups everybody's game. They're investing in growth initiatives like marketing, like support, like the tech stack, you know, like more people on the team. All of that is good. I actually think one of the most positive things happening now is private equity entering at the franchisee level, right? So they're looking for opportunities and they're rolling up, they're consolidating in large scaled systems where you can build scale. But that sets up a really fascinating dynamic, right? Think about the mandate of a private equity firm as a franchisee underneath another private equity sponsor who owns the brand, right? Or a publicly traded. So now we've got, you know, some very smart groups with potentially different investing mandates going head to head, right? So I think, you know, traditionally, if a franchisee is not happy in their system, they can lobby for change. They can try to get other franchisees around them to lobby for change. But I think this dynamic where PE is now at the franchisee level really accelerates that discussion, because no matter how data-based or numbers-driven a franchisee is, and especially multi-unit owners are really on top of their numbers, right? Private equity guys are on steroids. All those people really are all about, they're all quants, no matter who they are. They're very smart. And so they come to this change discussion armed with data. And the management teams are not always ready to have that blunt of a conversation, particularly if the data says that the management team is not putting the business in the right direction, right? So I think that's positive. It shines a flashlight on what we need to do to improve the business for the betterment of the brand and franchisees. But it is a change in how franchises are run and what some of these management teams need to contend with. Like, look, some of these big systems like Orange Theory and Planet Fitness, more than half of their units are owned by private equity. You know, that's a big block of owners, right?
It's a big block of owners, right? Yeah. And they have a lot of say, right? They have a lot of say. The more units you have, yeah.
Yeah. They have a lot of say. They're not, you know, they're not emotional about it, and they band together quickly. Like, here's the data. Here's what the data says. Here's, you know, here's our response to this.
But that ultimately makes the systems better, because if you have a
monumental shift,
right?
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, if you have these franchisees, that's why I think it's largely positive. Yeah, I agree. And I think if you have these franchisees with great data and their PE themselves, and they come in and they go, as you said, you know, like a, you know, an Orange Theory or something, and they go to the franchisor side and go, hey, look, we've studied this. Here's the report. Here's how we make ourselves better, which will likely lead to X, Y, or Z. If I'm a franchisor, I love that. I love that. Now it's all
you
about
it's nuance.
It's nuance, right? Yeah. Not everybody, right?
But if a corporate management team likes top-down management, they don't like to be challenged by franchisees. And this is where everybody loses their way in franchising, no matter who the ownership is. If that relationship isn't good, and you don't trust each other, and you don't have some sort of productive way to talk through differences of opinion and insights that you're getting from the field, you're gonna stall out at some point. So it doesn't matter if you're publicly traded or private equity backed, like that mechanism has to really gel. And I think all of these, you know, PE folks coming in at the unit level are challenging brands to operate in different ways and to really improve in those areas. And that to me is positive. Now, there's lots of systems where there's no PE at the unit level at all, right? So just to clarify, but in systems where they're very active, I think it's positive for those brands, and it can be tough for those management teams, but tough in a good way. You know, I'm an ex-franchisee here, so I see it as positive.
Well, Alicia, it's always great to talk to you. The book, Big Money in Franchising, I encourage everybody to go to Amazon, go to your local bookstore, go pre-order it, buy it. It's coming out to the market on March 12th. I think it's going to do phenomenally well. You're very well studied, got a lot of experience, and this conversation has been very, very interesting. And I always enjoy talking to you. Additionally, you can be reached at amiller@emergentgrowthadvisors.com. That's amiller@emergentgrowthadvisors.com. Thanks for coming on, Alicia. I really appreciate it.
I love the conversation. Always nice to see you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Franchise Euphoria. If you'd like to get a hold of me or learn more about our franchise services, please go to indyfranchiselaw.com. That's indyfranchiselaw.com. Also, please know that the conversations and information shared on this podcast are for educational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice. Until next time, happy franchise.